Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody from Chicago, Illinois, and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Ryan Jones, the CTO and co-founder, and Justin White, the CEO and also co-founder of a leading cybersecurity firm known as Digital Silence. They're based in Denver, Colorado. Ryan and Justin, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Yeah, anytime, man. This is great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. Now, we looked at both your bios, and I'll let you kind of decide who wants to go first, but you both seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us, like, how you got started and some of the highlights of both of your careers, please?
Yeah, Justin, why don't you go first with this one?
Yeah, good to talk with you, Ravi.
Thank you.
My career started, from a standpoint of I got into computers at a young age. My parents found that those are the greatest babysitter ever, was to just let me have at it. So from there, I actually joined the Army and went in the infantry, did nothing with computers, but had enough of a background that I still kept having fun with them. After leaving, I went to school and got a degree in forensics, which was led me down the path. Working in forensics for a while, I transferred over more onto the offensive security side after that. Ryan?
Yeah, so mine was similar, just no Army. My parents, my dad brought home a computer and I think I was like 9 or 10. Took it apart, put it back together, wanted to know everything I could about it. That was back in the BBS days when I was talking on BBSs. So I bounced around a lot of BBSs, played with phones for a while. I did attempt to go to college briefly for about 2 months and hated it. So I quit and started working. And around that same time is when all my friends were like, hey, you should come over here and help us. We're hacking this. We're hacking that. So I kind of literally grew up with the security industry.
Okay. Cool. Now, do you have any certs or anything? Because I know in the world of pen testing, there's a whole wide range of certs that one can get. Do you have any certifications, both of you?
Well, I have a CISSP.
Oh, wow.
I got mine back in 2001, when it was still a little tricky. I'm sure it's still tricky. I've heard some changes in the tests over the years, but I got my CISSP back in 2001, mainly because a customer required it. They're like, if you want this job, someone has to have a CISSP. So I found the next testing site and went over there and took the test. Other than that, no, I don't have any. I've got lots of little small ones that I've pulled from vendors over the years, but I respect the OSCP, a bunch of those certs, but I don't have them myself. I know Justin's got a few.
But, yeah, tell me, Justin.
Yeah, so luckily I got to go to school under vocational rehab from the military, and one of the things they did really push me to do was get certifications. So I ended up with a certified ethical hacker, certified hacking forensic investigator, certified pen tester, certified forensic examiner.
Oh my God.
Security plus, A plus, private investigator in the state of Colorado, and ITIL. I thought I was going to be going a lot more into the government realm, where the security plus, CEH, and ITIL were really important. Yeah, it's been one of those things. In Colorado, up until this year, you had to be a private investigator to actually do forensics. And there's a lot of states out there that still require you to be a private investigator to do forensics.
Wow, oh my gosh, you can't. I'm just trying to study for the Security Plus, and I'm having a hard time with that. Oh my God. Congrats on all those certs. And also, Justin, I want to tell you thank you for your service in the military. Just thank you so much for that. Now, how did you both venture into Digital Silence? Is this a company that you both started, obviously, I'm assuming? And how did you get started and kind of where have you been and where are you at right now?
So we both started Digital Silence together, along with a third partner named Dan Nelson, who is a recovering lawyer, as he likes to put it. But he's also the only lawyer I've ever met with a CEH certification. So when Justin met him and found that out, his ears perked up, and that's kind of how Dan got brought into this. But we were both we're both working for other companies, and we're both, I don't know, disenfranchised or unhappy with where we were in those companies. And so we started talking, and we're like, screw it. We should stop making everybody else rich and try making ourselves some money. Because Justin had been doing this for, I think, about 15 years at the time, and I'd been doing it for about 25 or 26. Cool. And, yeah, I mean, we were at the point where, okay, everybody's made money off of us. It's time to make money ourselves. And we were also wanted to have a company where we feel that we do the right things. Our goal is to help our customers, and that goal is really almost superseded by everything else, for lack of a better way to put it. I think we focus heavily on making sure we do, no matter how small or large the job is done well, with the purpose of helping our customers in whatever their little area is that we're doing a test for them for, general consulting or whatever the project is. But I think we both wanted to have a little more control over things so that at the end of the day, we both, all three of us, feel that, the right job's getting done each time. It's not a rush thing, not one of those things where, we can do a level one pen test for you, which is really just a vulnerability scan with no information. We wanted to make sure we did the right job and the best job for our clients to give them those bang for their buck.
Okay.
You have anything to add to that, Justin? Did I miss anything?
Can you still hear me, Robbie? Apparently my headphones just decided to go dead. Good. And the other thing that we really wanted to focus on is the culture of our company. One of the things, Ryan was speaking of what we like to do for our clients, for our testers and stuff and the people that we work with, we kind of have a different outtake on intellectual property. A lot of companies you go into work for, if you develop something, it's the company's. We have strayed really far from that. If you develop something, that's yours, and it's yours to keep when you leave, if you leave. And also, if it's something that could be profitable, Dan, again, being a lawyer, helps our team take some of their projects to market and with their own LLCs and stuff. And we don't ask – we don't for monetary from that from our people. That's theirs. They created it, and we want them to be proud of that. So it's a lot different of an approach on how we employees, I guess, in comparison to what disenfranchised both Brian and I from other organizations we'd worked with.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard anything like that. Wow. Okay. How long have you guys been in business? Has it been around for a number of years, or?
So we started back in 2017, so this September will be our fourth birthday. We made it through a pandemic, which, as a small business owner, if you ever want something that stresses you out, have a pandemic while you're running a small business.
Oh, yeah.
We're still a little bit in the startup mode, I'm pretty proud that we're just about to the 4-year mark.
Yeah, well, congratulations. My hat's off to you on that.
I'm sorry, can you say that one again?
No, were you wanting to say something, Ryan, or no? Okay. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, or are you just like local to the Colorado economy, or do you have clients, I'm assuming, nationwide too?
We have clients nationwide, and we also while we don't have points of presence outside of Denver, really, we do go everywhere. You know, Justin and I went on one trip shortly after the company started. That was literally a round the world trip from Denver to China to Singapore to Australia, Brussels, right? I think it was Brussels, and South Africa, Brazil, and Mexico before we finally got to go home. That was so. Yeah, we'll go anywhere. We've got enough vaccines in us to pretty much take on anything at this point. And we've got more passport pages than we know what to do with. So.
Wow, wow. So what prompted that world tour? Yeah, just a bunch of pen testing jobs? Or?
Yeah, that ended up being a group of pen testing jobs, and it was just kind of lined out to where we could get everything back to back to back to back, which made it a lot of fun. We will say flying Mango Airline in South Africa is an interesting experience if you ever get the chance. Borderline on almost charging you for a seatbelt. So,
Mango
Air, what a company.
Yep. They charge for everything. I know everybody here is like, oh, it's like a Frontier. Frontier charges for everything. Frontier will at least give you a seatbelt without charging you $25 for the seatbelt.
Well, is it a safe airline? I mean, do they do their security checks? Are their aircraft pretty? They airworthy?
They seem to be airworthy. We got there and back in one piece, so you know we survived a round trip flight on them. But they're a busy airline as well. I mean, that plane was packed.
Wow. Okay. Well, how is South Africa like? So I know I've had a couple of podcast guests down there, and I know there are a lot of biometric companies down there. That's how I got started in the world of security, was through biometrics. How is the culture like down there? How's the security mindset down there?
You know, the company we were doing the work for, they were fairly receptive to everything we were doing. As far as culture outside of that company goes, I mean, there's a very large gap, and you can't miss it, between the haves and the have-nots down there. You know, we were staying in Durban, which is on the east coast of the country, and you know, we'd be walking around the little downtown area, and you'd see, you know, $100,000, you know, in the States they'd be $100,000 cars or more, lots of kids, lots of money, really nice houses, and then you drive 5 minutes out and you're in the shacks built of plywood on the side of a hill. You know, entire communities, you know, that don't have running water, or, you know, they have to go somewhere to get the water every day, that kind of thing. So, culture-wise, it's incredibly, there's a giant gap in their social standings, I guess would be the way to put it. I mean, like I said, there's rich people and then there's very poor people. There's nothing really in between. But I mean, the city overall, everybody was friendly. You know, we had a good time. We got to go swimming with sharks out there. That was fun.
Oh, wow.
No cage, just sharks and snorkel gear. So, no, I mean, it's a beautiful country. I mean, as much as we drove around it, it was very pretty.
Well, excellent. Well, it sounds like you guys had a really good time there. So that's going to be your next vacation spot then, or?
If things ever get back to normal, maybe so. I wouldn't mind going back. I liked it down there.
Cool, awesome. Well, who's the typical customer you're trying to target? Is it the Fortune 500, federal government, SMBs, or pretty much everybody who needs a pen test?
So we really don't hold a line on where exactly we're looking. We've worked with everything from Fortune 10 to mom and pop. As far as pen testing, with all of our backgrounds here, the government area is always interesting to try to get into. We continue more and more to try to get into it, but it's its own set of headaches. But from like the more civilian market, we've done everything. So we don't say that we have a certain size that we work with.
Okay.
Yeah. No, and I know you were asking, you're kind of asking for a sweet spot, and honestly, we haven't. I guess small to mid-sized business is probably the majority of our clients, but like Justin said, we also deal with a fair number of much larger companies. So, and we do just as good work. You know, we get just as good feedback from them on what they think of our work. So, it sounds like we're doing the right thing for a little bit of everybody, which I won't complain about that.
Now, do you do your stuff mostly, or do you actually go on site and do pen testing?
Well, with COVID, we haven't been going on site as much, obviously. There have been one or two clients that didn't seem to mind us being on site for some internal testing. But we've basically been having them set up a virtual machine inside their environment, and we use VPNs to connect to those. Or we can ship them a device with all of our tools already on it that would call home and let us connect to it that way. Before that, we were doing a fair amount of travel. Before last year in March, we were traveling a fair amount. And I'm sure we'll get back to that to some extent, but we also try not to make anybody travel too much. So there's certain employees we have that love to travel. Others that don't, we try to keep that in mind when we're assigning projects. If you want to travel, you'll travel. If you don't want to travel, we'll do it as little as possible.
Maybe you can work
lately over the last year. We've got spots. Ever since COVID, things have calmed down as far as travel goes. We've had a couple of trips, and that's about it. Most of the work now is remote, over the phone, sending documents back and forth over secured methods. All of our clients have been really receptive to spinning up virtual machines for us and just putting whatever we want on it and letting us test that way, at least from the inside.
Now, do your clients make use of AWS or Azure, or what do you primarily use the most for the virtual machines and the desktops and so
forth? We see a lot of Azure and AWS, not so much Google, not so much, hosting.com or any of those other cloud, Linode and all those guys, but a lot of Azure and a lot of AWS. I'd say those are the two predominant cloud infrastructures we run into.
Is there one that's more favored than the other, or do you guys have a personal preference?
It doesn't really make a difference to me. Justin, do you have a preference of Azure versus AWS?
I found AWS is sometimes a little less fussy to work with than Azure. It's now becoming a real toss-up, though, because I think both organizations are learning from each other. I don't know. I think I'm still a little bit partial to AWS just because I've worked with it more. But I don't think either one of them are doing a bad job as far as security.
Okay.
I have noticed on both of them. I was going to say, I have noticed on both of them. They've gotten to the point now where they make it really difficult to improperly configure something overall. I mean, you've got to really ignore a bunch of warnings that they give you when you go to click something and they're like, are you sure you want to do this? Because you're opening this up to the world right now. They didn't used to be that way. They've gotten a lot better over the years, thankfully. I have noticed with both of them, it's really difficult to misconfigure something unintentionally.
Right. Well, I mean, I've been reading a lot of stories about like the S3 services and Amazon being misconfigured and that they get the blame for, any security breaches. So I'm sure it's probably been a catalyst, for all these, messages that are popping up.
Definitely.
One question I want to ask you. I've talked to many, many pen testers on podcasts, and I know a lot of them personally. They often say spinning up a virtual machine, as you guys said, and using that to do the pen testing. What if a client has like an on-prem server, and how would they move that to a virtual? What do you mean by spinning up a virtual machine and testing from that? I mean, I know in theory what you're talking about, but like, what if a customer doesn't have a cloud solution or things on-prem? So how do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, if they don't have a cloud solution, then we can just send them a small little PC that they would plug into their environment, would call home to us, and we would connect to it over a VPN that way. The VM solution is most of our clients we've come across have already had some kind of VM infrastructure built. It's fairly rare actually that we aren't able to spin up something inside their environment. And like I said, when that does happen, we send a device to them instead of trying to use a virtual machine.
Okay. Now, I was been at your website. I love your website, by the way. Very nice, very nicely laid out there. You mostly are in penetration testing. I know a few different things like red teaming, pen testing, web app security testing, security awareness training, forensics. As I said, I've talked to a lot of pen testers. They specialize in one area. But it seems like you guys are kind of more like a one-stop shop. Am I correct in my thinking? And like, can you elaborate more on these different services that you have? And which one kind of works the best for you? I mean, like, what do customers – what really seems to resonate with the customers the best, as I should say?
Sure. So as far as what – I'll expand on them a little bit first, and I'll let Justin take over. So we do the application and network pen testing. That's I think when we started the company, that was going to be our main those were going to be our main offerings along with digital forensics. One thing we don't do is incident response. We have some partners outside of Digital Silence that will refer clients to if they need incident response or if they really want us to do something involved in the incident response, we can we'll do like an overall managing of the incident response. If it's they've got multiple vendors in there trying to tell them what to do, we can do a management of that incident response. So that's fairly rare for us. Most of our work is pen testing and forensics at this point. And then we have another side of the company, sort of, I guess it's another side. We fractional CISO or virtual CISO, that's kind of the overarching title for our more general security consulting services where we're, doing things like helping a client get ready for CMMC or ISO or whatever whatever their problems are. We even had clients that just like, they come to us and they said, look, I know we need security. I have no idea what I'm doing. So please come in and help and give us some guidelines. And that's where we sort of, guide them towards best practice, especially if there's not a compliance framework they have to meet. We'll go for best practice because that seems to, if you do a true best practice security environment, then you're gonna meet all of your future or current compliance regulations, I think. So those are the main ones. We do red teaming as well, which, to us, red teaming is a combination of physical, social, and electronic testing. And those are, I think those are probably the most fun projects because everybody gets to play a little bit, have some fun, and do things that, while we all love doing them, we don't necessarily get to do them very often for work. So things like lock picking and dressing up like a delivery guy or applying for a job at the company that's the target.
Seriously?
Those are all fun.
Are you serious?
Yep, somebody...
I thought pen testing was more of the cloak and dagger, with a pen tester sitting in like a little hoodie, in a dark room. But wow, you guys actually did stuff. So do you have like
no James Bond card. Just a get out of jail free letter that we all keep on us when the clients are asking us to break into places. So that if for some reason somebody got caught, that get out of jail free letter lets the person that caught them know, like, hey, call this person, reach out, don't just have them arrested, please. And we make sure that things are set up very well in advance of those red team tests, so that if something were to happen and go wrong, then there's a definite process that is followed so that no one, gets arrested, goes to jail, gets in major trouble. The idea is to stop that process before the police get called, basically.
Well, has that ever happened to you where the police were called when you're doing a red teaming exercise? Or?
It hasn't happened to me personally. Justin, have you had the cops called on you on a red team?
I've spent a couple of quality evenings in the back of a police car. It's definitely one of the hazards. One of the first places I ever worked for.
Okay, wow.
Job description, so it actually said, must not mind spending a night in jail, which I thought was hilarious. And I'm like, oh, well, sounds like my normal weekend. So, yeah, that worked out well for that first job.
Oh, man. So basically, red teaming is more of a social engineering, like exercises for physical access entry, right?
Well, it's more of, I guess, maybe a blended threat. I mean, if you, I'm sorry, say that again.
Yeah, when you go into more detail, like what a red team test or assessment is, that's one of the questions I was going to ask you a little bit later. But let's just go ahead and talk about that now. What really defines a red team test?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's more of an open scope. I guess maybe the best way to think of that. I mean, there's still restrictions in place based on the client. You know, don't cause damage. Don't do this. Don't do that. But typically, it's a combination of physical attacks on one or multiple locations. In order to get access to the internal network, which once the internal network has been accessed, you know, through a leave behind or whatever, that leave behind then calls home to another team member, who can then use that leave behind to start penetrating the internal network to get more information. But before any of that even happens, there's a fair amount of reconnaissance done, both using things like open source intelligence techniques as well as some social engineering. And our OSINT team does a great job of pulling all that information together for us before we even get on site. And that's without the proper amount of reconnaissance, you're kind of walking blind. Reconnaissance, I think, is probably the biggest part, most important part of the red team, because when we do a pen test, for example, just a plain old network pen test or application pen test, you know, they're giving us the IP addresses, they're giving us the scope, they're giving us the URL or credentials or whatever we need for the test. When it comes to red team, they're not really giving us much of anything other than what not to do. So everything after that point is on us to find and to in order to identify the attack environment, like how much, you know, what all there is out there for us to attack, we have to do a lot of reconnaissance. And that covers going after, you know, finding out what IP addresses are assigned to them, finding out what buildings they're using, finding out how their employees communicate, you know, what type of software they use, poking at their websites a little bit to see if we can get in anywhere there. So red teaming is when you said earlier that, you know, pen testing is more the James Bond guy in a He's sitting in the basement. To me, red teaming is more of the James Bond type testing than a regular network or application pen test.
Well, do you have any client success stories, or do you have any favorite projects that you pulled off to talk about?
I know Justin's got one that he loves talking about stealing babies out of hospitals.
Oh, what? Oh, man.
We were contracted to help with a healthcare organization in understanding the potential pitfalls of a good social engineer and somebody who could set up, you know, different attack vectors. They tasked me with actually getting into birthing units, and they had a recessive baby that was in each one of the birthing units that I knew where it was. They would tell me that, but the goal was for me to actually get in there and remove the recessive baby with an actual ankle band and stuff with it on there for the security of the hospital and be able to get it out and prove that it could be done. My ploy was, is I was the summer IT intern, and I was just there to fix things. And it became kind of funny. By the second one of these I'd done, I ended up doing 22 hospitals in total. By the second one, I started feeling bad about what I was doing and then started actually fixing stuff while I was there as well, like rerouting printers and things like that. So, yeah, I ended up having a very high, very, very high success rate of the hospitals of being able to remove the recessive baby from the hospital. And it was really neat because they took a lot of what I said and actually put it into practice moving forward. But it also showed them, you know, somebody, we did a lot of OSINT work on that before. I created myself a hospital badge. My background, I actually do have some medical training in my background, so I understood a lot of the lingo that was being said. which made it easy for me to move around within a hospital. So, yeah, it ended up being really interesting and very eye-opening to the organization, and they were very receptive on it. So, you know, it's neat when you see your work actually get turned into something positive afterwards.
Wow. Wow. Ryan, do you have any stories you'd like to share with us, or?
Yeah, I was actually, while Justin was talking, I was trying to pick one, because I've got a few that I like to tell, but I think he said that he felt bad on the second job, or the second location that he went to. That kind of reminded me of one where it was a power company, and the goal was to sneak in every day, sit down, do a pen test on the internal network, but no one was supposed to know I was there except for this one the gentleman who hired us. He had no idea what I looked like. I had a get out of jail free letter, but it was as simple as tailgating in every day. And I just picked an empty desk. And when I sat down at the desk and I went to plug my laptop in, there was a nice lady sitting in the cubicle behind me. And I was like, damn it, I can't get an IP address. And she was, oh, do you need some help? And I said, yeah, I would love some. And so she actually called IT for me to come activate the port, the network jack that I was trying to use. So I got everything I needed to from that. And then I was doing the pen test day after day after day. And the whole time she's bringing me, this lady was so nice. She thought I was there. I had told her I was there for orientation. I was a new employee from another office in another location. And they'd sent me here for a week to do orientation and training. And so she was bringing me coffee while I was working. She, you know, she'd go get lunch and she'd bring me back a coffee because she found out what I like to drink. And then the last day, I was doing this for 5 days. On the last day, I instead of going to my desk, I went to the guy's office who had hired me and sat there and waited for him when he walked in. He's like, I thought that was you. I saw you sitting in the cube. I didn't know it was you for sure. And then when I went back to the desk to grab some of my stuff and get out because the job was done, the lady had found out that Friday was going to be my last day because I was going back, quote unquote, I was going back to the other office to do my job. And so when I got back to my desk after talking to the point of contact, the lady had apparently baked an entire plate of cookies for me as a going away present. And I was like, God, I felt, that's when I felt bad because I immediately realized I had been lying to someone's grandmother all week, who was the nicest lady ever. And I was just trying to be helpful. But yeah, she was great. That's when I felt the worst on the job. And then we had another job. We were using RFID cloners and all kinds of stuff to get into this bank, basically, yeah, their data center. We used an RFID cloner. Basically, we tried a bunch of stuff. We tried, you know, dressing up. We tried, you know, using a bunch of different scenarios to get into the data center. It wasn't working. And finally, on our second to last day, I was like, screw it. We're gonna sit in the parking lot across the street from their parking lot around 11:30 in the morning. And we're gonna wait for somebody. We're gonna wait for two guys to get in the same car, and that's who we're gonna follow. We're gonna follow wherever they go. And my coworker's like, why are we gonna follow two guys? I'm like, two guys getting in the car together 99% of the time are gonna be going to lunch. They're not going to a doctor's appointment together. They're not going to they're probably not going to the gym together. Because of the time, they're going to lunch. So if they go to lunch and they do what everybody in the world does and hang their badge off their belt or don't protect their badge, we'll clone it. We'll stand behind them in line or we'll get close to the table and we'll clone it, and then we'll use that to get in. And so that's exactly what we did. We followed two guys to a pizza place and stood behind him in line. And when I waved the RFID cloner over his badge that was hanging over his belt, it beeped, and because I forgot to turn the sound off on it. And he turned around, looked at me, I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, that was my phone. And then my coworker, who was with me, decided he didn't want pizza and was very vocal about it. And decided he started screaming at me that he wanted Chinese food. So we left the pizza place and went and used the RFID badge or the RFID cloner to get into the data center. Ended up getting access to their data center, all the cubicles that were in that data center because there were a lot of people that worked in that particular data center. And then we also got access to their Swift terminal at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I sent our point of contact a picture of me in front of the Swift terminal with a command that would have transferred a lot of money out of their accounts and into my my checking account, which probably never would have gone through. But the point was that we'd gotten there, and and I figured out the command to do it. So, yeah, he texted back, and he's like, "What are you doing in my data center? It's 3 o'clock in the morning." I'm like, "Well, no one's throwing me out." And then I guess he took a better look at that picture. He's like, "Please don't hit enter right now. You'll bankrupt three small countries." And I went, "Well, which three? Because it might be worth it." Yeah, those are we have a fair amount of story. We could do hours of stories, but yeah, those are my two favorite.
Well, getting more. I mean, we have one or two more. Are you going to move on to other points of the podcast? It's up to you.
Oh, I was just going to say one other funny one. Brian said about data centers was I was trying to get into a data center and couldn't get a clone badge, but had a badge that looked real enough, and they actually were doing two-factor authentication, and I walked in with Band-Aids on my pointer fingers and told the guy I was learning to play guitar, and he actually let me not use my fingerprint to get in and just went off my ID badge. So, yeah, there's all sorts of fun things and nefarious things that can happen when you're trying to get into places.
Right. You got anything more you'd like to add on there?
No, that was it.
Well, have you guys thought of writing a book about all your experiences? Hello?
Hey, Brian's on mute.
I've thought about it. Lately, I haven't had the time to even begin writing. But yeah, I've thought about it. I've had a friend of mine that we've been friends for 20 years. We've been in the industry together the whole time. We were actually talking about writing a book of all these different stories, and then having at the end of each chapter or the end of each story. A psychologist or you know, a shrink basically write about how fucked up everything we did was. how obviously we're twisted mentally and need help. But yeah, no, it would be fun to write a book before we get too old and forget all these stories.
Cool. Well, let me ask you one thing. What kind of mindset does it take to become a successful pen tester? Obviously, there's both a digital and a physical sides of it. What kind of mindset do you need to have to really be a good pen tester?
That's a good question.
I think the biggest thing is curiosity. A lot of us, when we really started getting into this, like back in the day, it wasn't as nefarious as everybody wants to make it out to be. A lot of us were just curious. I do get to hear a very funny story from Ryan's dad one time of that computer that he brought home that Ryan took apart and put back together. Let's just say his dad was not that happy about it. He was very happy it turned back on at the end of the story. But, you know, there's a natural, like, need to know how something works, I think, with, like, really good pen testers. There's a certain part of, like, just enjoying solving puzzles. Because we've had people that, you know, have come from all walks of life. One of our OSINT practitioners, she was a chocolatier that actually just wanted to do things better after her identity got stolen and then got into OSINT. And now works with a bunch of different groups like ILF, which is going after child predators, innocent life, and then other organizations that are actually looking for missing and exploited children. Operation Safe Escape, she works with to help people of domestic violence. So that was her curiosity, was how she could help people out in the virtual world. So to me, I think one of the biggest things about being a good pen tester is just being curious and having that like spark of I need to know.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd say curiosity, and I honestly, and I guess this hopefully comes with curiosity, is a self-drive to learn. The industry is not, I mean, I don't think the industry is secretive overall when it comes to how to do things or how to do pen tests. I think most people in our industry like teaching, like talking about this stuff because they're passionate about it. in the first place, and that it's just what they love. So that passion, that drive, that's something else I look for when we got to hire people. You know, yes, I want you to have technical abilities, and I want you to be smart, and I need you to be able to write a report, because that's what in the end, that's what the client's paying for, is the report. But I also, you know, I want to make sure that you enjoy what you do. I want to make sure that you're constantly, you know, learning a new trick or going off and doing research that you find interesting, because it's fun. That's how you're going to keep yourself from going crazy, honestly.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Now, I've got to ask you one thing. Before you engage a client, before you actually do a pen test exercise, what are all the legalities that you have to take into consideration? What are all the legal paperwork that you have to go through to make sure that everybody knows that your ethical hacker is not going to do something wrong? And if you do something wrong, like something goes bad, like you hit a database and something happens, there's a cascading failure, how do you deal with all that, with like non-intentional side effects of the job?
Well, so all from a process standpoint, we've got plenty of thankfully since Dan's, you know, was a lawyer, the legal paperwork and all that we've managed to keep fairly streamlined. We've got make sure there's a signed statement of work, make sure there's terms and conditions in that statement of work saying what we're trying to do and what we're not trying to do, and making sure that the legal paperwork doesn't just protect us, protects the client as well. We do also have a kickoff call with the client with all their team members that are needed, so that we can answer any questions, kind of go over the methodology we use and explain to them, like, here's all of our contact information. Here's how to get a hold of everybody. If something starts acting funny or something goes down, or, you know, it shouldn't, because that's not our goal. But, you know, sometimes stuff reacts weird to in-map. SCADA is a perfect example of that. I mean, you could port scan a certain industrial devices, and they're going to crash the second it hits more than 5 ports at once. We do try to give them a heads up on possible issues before we go down that, before we even get started on the test. We want to make sure that they're comfortable with everything and that they know not just what to expect, but, you know, if something does go wrong or go askew unexpectedly, that they have, you know, 9 different people to get a hold of to make sure that we stop and figure out what's going on, you know, what happened and why did it happen. We don't want to just knock the company down for a day and be like, oh, well, we were testing. The purpose of this test is to make sure that things are as normal as possible during the test, so that, you know, we can see what risks are in the environment normally. We don't want them to make changes as we're doing stuff. We don't want them to make a bunch of, you know, apply a bunch of patches all of a sudden in the middle of the test, because, you know, that wasn't how the situation was when we started the test. We want them to get a true feel for, you know, what risks exist in the environment with the way you do business in day-to-day operations. I think that answers your question, with probably a little extra expounding.
Well, this, I don't know if you want to answer this one or not, but have you guys like ever faced a lawsuit or been sued or anything like that because of something went wrong that was not intentional or something, or non-intentional?
No.
Like a side effect or something?
We've never had that come across. We have had the frantic phone call more than once from a client. Our guys are actually pretty amazing at getting in stealthily. Last Thursday, they were doing a great job, and they were kind of doing the, as they refer to it, it's the victory lap, and it set off basically, they were intentionally trying to set off all the internal tripwires, and we got a very frantic phone call. Our testing methodology, like, we won't do anything that will – we try not to do anything that will bring a client down. Our big thing is, if I knock it down, I can't steal from you. And we try to even our pen test, we try to get a client to understand, like, attackers, you know, unless you're in an organization that, you know, you have to worry about hacktivists and things like that, most people are having to deal with the fact that somebody's trying to get in and steal information. So, you know, we don't do stuff like DDoS attacks or things like that. We try to keep everything open to where we can take stuff. And, you know, at this point, we're very transparent with our clients. Like, as Ryan was saying, a lot of the paperwork says this can be disruptive. And I think that's helped a lot. You know, when crafting the paperwork, we do make it very clear that, like, if something happens, please call. You know, and I think that's helped us avoid any kind of lawsuits.
Okay.
And I think, and you know, going back to that kickoff call, we ask it. You know, that's another time where we ask a bunch of questions to try and get a feel for, you know, maybe what segments in the network are a little less stable than others. Try to get a feel for, you know, how are different sites of a client. You know, if a client has a site in Denver and a client and a site in Chicago, how are those offices connected? You know, what kind of connection is that? Because you can crash a VPN pretty easily trying to do a pen. You know, if you're trying to run a tool like Nmap or something over it at full bore or really fast, you'll suck up 62,000 connections, simultaneous connections, pretty quickly if you're running things too quickly. So we do ask a bunch of questions in those kickoff calls to try and get a feel. I guess maybe just a general feel for the environment. We don't want to know too much information, right? We don't want to taint the test by us having too much information. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're aware as much as possible of things like, oh, well, this segment's where all of our industrial control systems are, or this segment's where our cameras and phones are. You know, we don't want to go knocking down all their phones and suddenly no one can make a phone call, sell stuff, or whatever their business is. So that we do take some additional questions in the kickoff call to make sure we get that feel.
Well, have you ever had an instance where you reached out to a client and they said, well, I don't know what I want. I leave up to you guys what to do.
Yeah, we get that a fair amount, actually. It's one of those things where we'll get an email. We'll get an email from a client that'll be like, oh, I need a red team. And it's, you know, it's a client, a brand new client. And the first question I ask them is, I'm like, well, if you even have a pen test or a vulnerability scan, or are you just going straight to red team? We have to, while it's exciting when a client calls up and says, I want a red team, because everybody wants to do a red team, it's also one of those things you got to kind of step back a second. Because if we just did a red team on you, you've done no work on your security program whatsoever, we're just going to run you over. And when you get the report, you're not going to know what to do with it. You're not going to know where to start. You're really just going to be like, you're going to freak out for a minute. You're going to shelve the report and you're not going to do anything to fix it. I think one of the things we try to do is let's start with the basics. Let's get the low hanging fruit knocked out of the way. Let's try and figure out your baseline first and how to improve that before we go doing a full bore red team and basically make you cry. Let's try to be a little more helpful than that. And you know, that's where you were asking about sweet spots earlier. That seems to be one of our sweet spots. A client that comes running to us saying, I need all this. And, you know, by the time the conversation's done, you know, we've asked enough questions to figure out, okay, what you really are looking for right now is this. Let's build up to doing a red team for you eventually. But right now, what you need to take care of are these much easier, smaller projects that you guys can handle right now. Yeah.
Okay.
we get a lot of issues where clients don't really understand what they're asking for, and we kind of have to clarify that before we get too far down the path.
Yeah, I mean, I've dealt with that too as a tech writer. I've dealt with that too, but probably not to the degree that you guys have. Wow, that's really interesting. Now, can you tell me more about your OSINT offering, please?
Hey, Justin, you want to take this?
Yeah. So with OSINT, you know, we all know, like, you know, security teams are doing everything they can within their four walls, and they're trying. It's really hard for them to understand what's going on outside their four walls. And that's kind of where our OSINT team does come in. We help a lot of organizations understand, you know, brand reputation, if people are talking about them on both the surface web and dark web. We help organizations a lot with trying to understand just attack vectors, like what information they're putting out there about it. And I think one of the greatest ones on that is looking at people either through their LinkedIn profiles that they've hired or people that are our job postings for potential new hires. A lot of times when we're doing our red teams and, this is like one of those, hey, we're not going to tell you anything about our organization. You need to figure it all out. That's the first thing we do is go to their job postings and start going through, okay, developer, find out, what languages they're wanting their developers to write in. Look for somebody that's working in IT. Okay, what systems are they using? Oh, they need you to be proficient in Windows. Cool, we know you're a Windows environment. So it's really helping an organization understand how big their digital footprint is and the information that they're putting out there and how a nefarious person could use it against them.
Excellent. Now, one thing I want to ask you is one of my go ahead.
I was going to say, I was going to say really quick, the OSINT that Justin just described, we also use that in all of our pen tests as kind of we try to do as much OSINT as possible for each of our big pen tests so that, when the client comes to us and they say, oh, we only have these, four subnets assigned to us, and then the OSINT person goes back to us and like, well, they actually have 12, and here's all their other domains that they had that they didn't know about, and here's all the other things they didn't know about. So, I mean, there is a fair amount of kind of eye-opening, I guess, maybe experience for some of our clients when they see the OSINT part of the report and they're realizing, like, they didn't even realize they had 27 domains. They only knew about 3. Those are the types of things where, losing track of those things happens because of employees leaving and going, coming and going, getting promoted, then it's no longer their responsibility. It doesn't always get communicated very well of what all's in place. So OSINT like that, kind of helps them re-identify, I guess, what all their footprint really looks like.
Okay. Now, I gotta be honest with you, one of my favorite areas of pen testing is that of web application security testing. In fact, my co-author and I, we co-wrote a book about that, and it got published last August, I think, through CRC Press. We wrote a whole book on that. And one of my areas of passion is that of API security. There are a lot of software developers all over the world where they use open source libraries, but they fail to test the security of those open source source codes. And that leaves the web apps to a lot of back doors for the cyber tech to get into. Now, do you guys pen test the actual source code? Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but do you guys like actually go through source code line by line to see where the vulnerabilities and the security weaknesses are too?
Yeah, we do code review. We consider that security code review. Just a funny side note, I had a wonderful gentleman that I used to work with, Mr. Antonio Herrera's. He told me the first thing you do is you dump the code and then do a control find and just look for fix this in the code. And that's where you find your security vulnerabilities. And sadly, to this day, I still use that. And that is where we find probably 40% of the security vulnerabilities. We do code review, which is, it's looking at it line by line. It is something that we definitely do.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, what's the difference between incident response, forensics, business continuity, disaster recovery? I have written a lot of articles about this for clients. I've had people ask me, like, what's the difference? To me, an IR is when you're responding to a cyber attack right at that moment. Disaster recovery is trying to bring up your mission critical operations within a few hours. And BC planning, business continuity, is more like for the long term, how you, recover from a security breach from the long term and come back to a sense of normalcy. So what's the difference between all of this to you guys? I mean, do you come across this kind of question quite a bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you're looking at incident response, you're trying to figure out how to plug that hole. You're trying to figure out the fastest way to make sure that no more damage is being done. And then I think you believe, and to me, incident response then also rolls into, okay, now let's start bringing the stuff offline and figuring out what we're going to do next with that. And then, like you said, the data recovery team comes in and puts that back up, or, you know, puts something back in place that they can use. And then from a forensic standpoint, that's where, you know, incident response and forensics a lot of times have to work hand in hand as they're figuring out those devices to remove. I always call it the CSI effect. There's not much we can do to run right there on the spot and tell you everything that's wrong. Most really good forensics to me is done post-breach. The machine's been taken offline. You can get it to a forensic examiner. They can make an image of it. They can start tearing through it, and they can start rebuilding what happened. So I think that's one of the biggest things that we try to talk to our clients about. One of our really good spots is we can either be the coach, the overall coach for it, or come in more at the post-breach forensics and really break down to a client how it happened. And from that standpoint, it's a very interesting way that I think we position ourselves a little bit different than other organizations is, you know, we're pen testers as well. So not only do we understand the exploits, we know how they're used, and it's given us kind of an advantage of being able to look at things and say, okay, this is what happened. This is how it happened. This is how the code was written for it to do it, being app testers as well. And really helping a client, you know, understand how it happened and how to make sure it doesn't happen again. Does that help you out, Robbie?
Oh yeah, definitely. Now, one thing I want to ask you is, I've got a very good friend of mine. In fact, my co-author, he owns another big pen tester firm in Utah, and half of his, well, I'd say 90% of his time is spent with writing proposals. How time consuming is that? I mean, it seems like every time I call him, I'm writing a proposal, I'll talk to you later. Does it take a lot of time to do a proposal, or what's the process with that?
It is. It's a lot of information gathering, and a lot of usually going back and forth to make sure that the client's happy with everything that they're looking at. I even as a CEO, I'm still a pen tester, but I would say my pen testing is probably down to about 30% of my job, and 70% is writing proposals. So, they do chew up some time, and a lot of that's also building the relationship with the client so that they want to come back and work with you. So it is like I can totally understand your buddy saying, "I'll call you back. I'm working on a proposal," because that's kind of that first benchmark when you're dealing with a client are they going to be happy with you? They do burn up a happy amount of time.
Wow. Well, how long are your proposals? Are they like doctoral dissertations, or 400, 500 pages, or just?
No, so more of our proposal time goes into the information gathering, to be honest with you. It's about depending if, you're going for a full pen test, it can be about 8 pages long for the customer to fill out. And sometimes we've got to be on the phone with them while they fill it out, because this is maybe one of their first tests, or they're not understanding what we're asking. And, there's some time that we need to help them to understand what we're asking for and why we're asking. We have tried to actually streamline our statements of work that we give to a client, to try to keep them under 1 to 2 pages. One of the biggest things that used to drive me nuts at different organizations that I worked with, when like trying to get a pen test, I didn't want 10 pages of fluff before I was actually looking at the price to what I was going to sign. Drove me nuts. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, I don't care where you work. What you do. I need to see the price. I need to sign a piece of paper. So ours are very streamlined. We've had a few clients push back. They're like, this isn't very professional. You're not telling us like every nut and bolt. And I'm like, okay. I mean, we can do that. It adds a lot of extra reading for you that is that what you're actually needing? A lot of, by the time we kind of talk to them, they're like, you know what? Actually, no, I don't need all of that. This is actually a lot easier. A lot of it is just helping those clients understand what they're asking for and getting them to understand, hey, yep, that's what I need. I understand why you're doing this. And I always kind of point this one out. We have like when we're asking clients, can we use our off network password cracker? It's physically here in our office, but we've had organizations that say no, we would prefer you not, actually try to crack all of our passwords. And we try to go into a little bit deeper understanding so that they understand why we're asking for stuff like that.
Okay. Excellent. Now, at the end of the engagement, do you come up with another document that kind of tells them what you found and how to fix it?
We do. We try to give them we can't be experts in everything. A lot of times our fixes are general recommendations. And by general, I mean pretty close to exactly what you need to do, but we're not subject matter I always use this one kind of like every different firewall that's out there. There's certain things that you can do just in best practices, and this is what you should be doing, but I can't tell you exactly how to do it on a Palo Alto versus a Sonic wall. We do some research to try to figure that out. But, a lot of it's sometimes a little bit, not super general, but does have some, how to fix it. And that's, again, like Ryan said, we have certain organizations that we've partnered with that if you need a lot of help, we have organizations that's what they specialize is in fixing things. And what's great doing it that way is they know what our reports are. They've worked with us enough in the past. They look at it and go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's exactly, we know what to do. So, yeah.
Yeah, we spend a fair amount of time on that. We've spent a fair amount of time on that final report because that's reflecting all the work we did. So to us, one of the things that we want to make sure and we do in our reports is, there's a whole section on our report that literally shows you not just what we did that worked, but also what didn't work. We want a client to know what technologies in their environment are working the way they are supposed to and stopping us from doing certain things, as well as, what's broken and needs to be fixed. The point of a test is to make sure things are working the way they are expected to, just as much as it is to find holes in the environment. So, we've got a whole narrative where it's, this is the tool we use to do this step, and here's the command line, and here's all the flags we used, and here's the configuration. By the time the client has the report in their hand, they have a document that can show them exactly what was done to the point of if they wanted to remediate something and then validate that finding was remediated, they can do it on their own if they wanted to because we've given them exactly how we found that problem. They can replicate every single step we took.
So you guys don't do actual fixes like post-op stuff then, right?
No, so we don't do hands-on key. Oh. We don't do the remediation steps. And there's a few reasons for that, but I think that the biggest one is, we can come in and say, apply all these patches and do this and do that. But we're not as familiar with how the company does business and how the company makes money. And so it's possible that those things are done in a riskier way for a business purpose. And if that's the case, then okay, well, let's figure out another solution to mitigate the risk, not make it go away, but at least mitigate it. Maybe it's something where you need to take this set of machines and segment them off into a certain, special network where it's harder for them to be reached across the board. Maybe it's a different configuration we need to try. Maybe it's monitoring for something. There's always a way to mitigate the risk. And one of the things that we pride ourselves on is when we give you that report, we don't just hand it to you and walk away. There's always our clients are always able to reach out to us and say, hey, so I was looking at this and I can't, I can't apply this patch because of XYZ reason. And then we'll sit down with them and try to figure out what's another solution to at least, resolve that problem in some way.
Now, I'm at your website again, and there's a couple more sources I want to just briefly talk about, like wireless security. Do you actually, like, go to a cafe and, like, take out your network sniffer and, like, capture all these passwords and usernames and do something that way? Or do you, like, jailbreak, like, iOS and Android devices? Or what do you focus on for that?
So with wireless security, it is as creepy as the coffee shop attacks. We have done those in the past. A lot of it, we have a few special little gadgets that we've built over the year. One of them is a flying drone that we can actually put on top of a building that can has a Raspberry Pi and a wireless card, and we have it call back to a on-the-ground computer and can do wireless attacks from the top of a building. That
Are
actually
you
happened
serious?
From a – yeah.
Wow, I've never heard of
so
do that before. Wow, really? I mean, we're excited
about
this.
The building we were going against frustrated me. They were doing great on wireless security. They had put the special film on all their windows, so they were not getting leakage out their window. I was just curious if they had the same protection on top of the building, which they did not have. So, yeah, that's how that little device got created. But yeah, we do a lot of wireless assessments, just trying to help. And a lot of it is just helping organizations to understand why you need a guest work network and why you need a corporate network. And should that corporate network, you know, how you're segmenting stuff with your wireless. A lot of organizations make simple mistakes like with that, with internal network segmentation from their wireless devices. And with wireless, we also look at, you know, Bluetooth. We consider a wireless. So we do a lot of Bluetooth attacks. We've done some pretty specialized attacking within medical devices that use Bluetooth. And then the final one's kind of RFID, as Ryan was talking about, helping organizations to understand RFID cloning and other things around hazards with RFID, and understand the importance of RFID and multi-factor. So, you know, have a card and a PIN number. It definitely makes it a nightmare for me to get in because I have to stand way too close for most people's comfort to get all that. So, you know, we do a lot of stuff around the kind of wireless realm to help organizations understand.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. Now I got to be honest with you. There are a ton of pen testing firms out there, as you were probably well aware of. I've probably interviewed 20, 30 pen testing firms on podcasts. What makes you guys different than from everybody else? Like, why should my company, AST Cybersecurity, come to you guys versus, like, one of my best friends who owns his own pen testing firms? What's that differentiator of yours that separates you from everybody else in the crowd?
So with some of the firms that are out there, and, you know, especially the larger firms, you sometimes get a bait and switch, which frustrates us. Sometimes they've got some really big names, and then by the time you get testers on something, you get junior testers that are doing the work. You know, they had the big name come in, make the deal, and then, you know, they use what they have so that they can be profitable. We don't take on every engagement. We have pretty much all senior pen testers. I think our most junior tester has 15 years of experience. So, you know, that's one of the things I believe sets us apart. And then our culture, you know, if you talk to any of our testers, that they're excited about being here. They will talk your ear off about some crazy side project that they're working on, and that we give our guys and gals time to do that, which, you know, makes it pretty different than a lot of organizations. Our reporting, you know, as part of the thing, the other reason Ryan and I kind of got disenchanted with the security industry was know, pen test reports kind of became one of those things like, how bad can we mess up your organization, come in, drop a report, and walk away? It was one of those things that always kind of frustrated me throughout the years of being a pen tester. And that's why we try to stay in contact with our clients. I was actually just putting out an email this morning from a client. They had a test done back in December, and they're just now getting to some of their findings here in March, and we're still in contact with them. You know, hey, this is where we saw it, and these were the ports. And I think that kind of us being a smaller organization, like we try to be a little bit more caring with our clients. I mean, there are a lot of great pen testing groups out there, and you know, the one thing I kind of look at is there is enough work for all of us, because definitely as far as how many places actually need a pen test, need information security, need help in that realm, way outnumber the number of businesses that do it.
right. Okay. Boy, I don't know where the time's gone, but it's really flown. We only have like maybe 18 minutes left the show, but I wanted to kind of come to this last part by talking about some of the hot-button topics in cybersecurity. One of them is the Internet of Things, and I find that to be a very scary proposition. I don't have a smart home. I don't have a smart car. As I said, I have an analog 2003 Honda Civic, which started first time in our sub-zero temperatures here we've had. What are your thoughts on the IoT? I mean, I like to be a very – in fact, I hate technology. I really do. But what do you guys think about the IoT? Is it a good thing, bad thing, or do you guys have smart
you know,
person?
Yeah, I always start off any conversation about IoT as the S in IoT stands for security. When you're looking at IoT, like, there is no security in it. Look at Ring, look at baby monitors, look at automobiles. Like, I mean, it is a scary Wild West world. Like I said, you know, you look at a lot of the medical device testing that we do, it is technically an IoT device. And, you know, it's a scary realm. And people are wanting to become more and more smart connected. I was actually given a talk last Thursday, trying to help people understand, and I actually had them sign in to their routers and at home and tell me how many devices were connected to their router. The record in one home was 79 devices connected to one router. They had a full smart home. And explaining to them, like, hey, do you know what that does? Do you know that has port 80 open? Do you know that has, it's running an embedded Windows, a Windows XP in your refrigerator, which is hackable. And so we were walking through everything, and it's mind-blowing. And to me, it's becoming more and more and more scary of how interconnected everything is. So, yeah, IoT is one of those things that definitely is a sweet and sore spot with me. I love having a bunch of different things to constantly test, even if just for my own curiosity. Ryan?
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I think IoT itself isn't good or bad. I think people just need to be aware of what they're buying. I mean, for example, go look on Amazon at the most popular security cameras for homes right now, and you're going to find a bunch of devices that are, you know, 20 to 50 bucks a piece, and they're made in China. And these people go off and they buy these things because they, you know, they either want them or they think they need them, or, you know, whatever the case may be, but it's affordable, so they go off and buy it. And they never do the research or never even try to see, you know, okay, what did I just introduce into my house? Can this camera be reached by anybody, or is this something that I can do on my own? Can I lock it down? I think when it comes to IoT overall, I think there needs to be – it'd be nice if there was some kind of standard on how to secure IoT devices. And I think a couple of organizations and people have tried to create that, but I don't think anything has gotten a true – industry accepted, or it hasn't been accepted across the industry yet when it comes to IoT devices. So I think it needs to be on the individual users to be aware of what they're keeping in their pockets, what they have on their wrists, what they have in their cars. And unfortunately, most of the people buying those things are not technology aware enough to understand what they're bringing into their homes. I think that's the true danger.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I'm glad you guys are with me on this one. Anyway, the next topic is artificial intelligence. I just got a book published on that, and it's one of the biggest buzzwords, and I think one of the most poorly understood jargons in cybersecurity. We hear the idea is we mimic the thought process of the human brain, but truth be told, we'll never understand the human brain. I mean, my dad was a professor of biology, a neuroscientist, and he said we're maybe at like just a 0.0001% of understanding what it's really all about. What are your thoughts on AI, and have you made use of AI in pen testing, like for automation procedures?
So to me, people use that term artificial intelligence a lot to sell their tools and solutions and whatnot. And I get it. They've got a lot of smart functionality built into it, and that's great. But to me, that's not artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is still, to me, the old sci-fi definition of, you know, it's going to be some kind of computer program that's self-learning, self-taught, you know, figures things, starts figuring things out on its own. That is, to me, an artificial intelligence. What people are selling right now as artificial intelligence overall is typically a bunch of scripts and a bunch of large data sets that they've been analyzing over and over to get patterns. I think someone started using the term artificial intelligence to describe that. And I don't think it's still not the right definition. It's not the right term for it. But Justin, I guess we have used artificial intelligence in the marketing term way to speed things up in some senses. I mean, yeah, there's tools we use that have that kind of predictive capability in it, I guess. And we do absolutely use that for speeding up our own processes and getting rid of the more time-intensive processes or scaling down the amount of time it takes for those types of processes is probably a better way to put that.
Yeah, and I think, the artificial intelligence, like Ryan was saying, gets thrown around and sometimes the wrong method. We've dealt with some organizations that say that, you know, they're using artificial intelligence for pen testing. And like, as you said, Ravi, very, very great point. So little is understood about the human brain. I can show you 10 places that set up their Windows AD, and I can show you 10 places that did it completely different than each other. Even though it's something that, like, you know, it's so basic, the human brain just looks at that problem differently. And to try to say that there's a tool or something out there that can match or note what an actual, you know, in a chair analyst or tester sees, I don't think we're at that point yet.
Yeah. All right, we'll never get there. I mean, we'll never get there. We can do heart transplants and, you know, do, you know, bypass surgery, but we'll never get to the point where we will understand the human brain. It's just one of those things, will we ever know if space ends or not, you know, like outer space. But anyway, the next hot topic is the COVID and the remote workforce. Now, of course, COVID-19, everybody's sick of hearing about it. But, you know, 1 year ago, we never thought it would reach the proportions that it would have, especially with the remote workforce. This was something that was talked about, you know, that'll happen 4 or 5 years down the road, but it's now happened, like, within 3 months. You know, we have, like, a near 99% workforce worldwide. How has that impacted you and your clients?
That was kind of like when we first started off, you know, we survived the pandemic as a company. As pen testers, or at least with our organization, it wasn't really hard to go remote. We're a bunch of basement dwellers to begin with, so it wasn't super hard. So yeah, it wasn't for our organization. It wasn't a big leap. The thing that hit us the hardest with COVID, to be honest with you, everybody else. Security went to a back burner for at least, we were very slow on things for about 4 months from about the end of April till late August, like crickets, unless it was something doing with post-breach forensics, which then really quickly kicked into organizations going, okay, we sent all these people home. We've just opened up a whole bunch of security holes. And I'll tell you what, like starting in September, our phone didn't stop ringing for 3 months of like, we've opened Pandora's box and we don't know how to fix it now. You know, it became, we kind of took on a little bit different testing model for a little while of kind of helping people backtrack on everything that they had to set up so quickly. And it's not a dig against the people who had to set it up quickly at all because they were under such time crunches. I mean, like you said, Ravi, the country went from, you know, mid-March by mid-May, 90% of the workforce was working from home. Nobody had that in their plans. So, you know, as much as technology had to be stood up that quickly, the security was pushed to the side. And then, like we said, we started seeing it. It started with breach or, you know, post-breach forensics for us and trying to figure out what went wrong so we could help organizations go in and harden stuff to where we started seeing enough of the same things going wrong that when we had other clients, we'd reach out and tell them what we were seeing. They started asking, like, can you take a look at this? And kind of word of mouth got around it. You know, we were doing that kind of testing and helping them look for these things prior to it happening. But we didn't even know, you know, what to look for until we saw some of the issues. So it was a very interesting time for a few months there.
Yeah, and we're starting to see more testing. We've started having some customers come to us with some interesting case scenarios where it's like, okay, so we're going to send you the exact same setup that we have for all of our remote workers. And we want to see, like, if a worker got hacked, you know, let's figure out what our risks are. Because, you know, these guys were, like Justin said, weren't ready for this. So they spun up as much as they could to get going. And now they're starting to realize, like, okay, we opened up some holes. Let's make sure we didn't open up the wrong holes. Let's make sure that the holes we did open just didn't lift our skirts up and give away the keys of the kingdom, right? So we've been doing some interesting testing with remote access solutions that some of our clients have been using now to find out what risks exist in those.
Well, another shameless plug for me. I've signed a book contract with the same publisher on writing a book on COVID, kind of like a how-to pandemic guide for the CISO. And a lot of the chapters are going to be like on pen testing, how to move stuff from on-prem to Azure. So I may tap into your knowledge base about that too. So I'll be reaching out to you guys again here soon. So I'm not one to go away quite yet. So anyway.
Yeah, no, that'd be awesome.
So now the next part is data privacy laws, GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, God knows what else is out there. Do you deal with those two or like the NIST frameworks? All right, here's a big thing, the CMMC. That's the big one right now.
So we have an employee who actually just finished his training for CMMC, for his RPO, right, Justin? Or RP?
Okay. Yeah, okay. CMMC. Because there's another framework.
So he's gone through all of his training for CMMC, getting ready for that. But that same individual, he's got this amazing spreadsheet that he uses that he built on his own, and it basically connects all the different compliance frameworks together. So when we have a client that comes to us and says, I want ISO or I want HIPAA or I want whatever, he gives them that, you know, he does audits, he basically does assessments and readiness assessments for them to go through those kind of audits, helps them out getting ready. That was kind of under that virtual CISO, fractional CISO flag that we were talking about earlier. But he comes in and he shows them one of the deliverables he gives to them is, okay, so you have to be compliant with this for right now, but these things might come down the road. So here's where what I told you to do for, you know, part 1.C of this compliance framework, here's where it ties into this other compliance framework. So he literally mapped out all the different compliance frameworks so that when he tells somebody, you know, to remediate something in a certain way, he doesn't just say it's for this part of this compliance. He can show them all across all the different compliance pieces where that one remediation takes care of all those different frameworks.
Is this publicly available on our website, or is it only like on a client basis?
It's not. We've kept that one. That is one thing we've kept kind of close to our chest. It is something that our clients get when a project is completed. It's a deliverable for the client. But it's not something we don't have it hanging out on the internet for anybody to download.
Okay. Well, finally, as we wrap up our show here, we got like maybe 4 minutes left. What do you think the cyber threat landscape is going to be like for the remainder of the year? Now that we're in March, going to be wrapping up Q1 here, what do you think the biggest threat variant is going to be?
My opinion on that, I think finally, after years and years of people screaming about supply chain, we're finally starting to see real attacks against the supply, like real methodical, thought-out, long-term planned attacks against the supply chain. And, everybody's talking about SolarWinds right now, but I mean, there have been the articles, and I don't know that I believe those particular articles about the special chip on motherboards of Apple and Amazon cloud servers,
right.
And,
yep.
All that. But I think that's finally coming into its own, unfortunately. There have been plenty of people in the security industry who have screamed and yelled about that for years, protect the supply chain. I think that's finally going to be. I think it finally is going to be the next true threat area. We were talking about red teaming earlier. One of the things we used to do with permission, we'd always clarify it. It was always one of the things that came up before the test started. But what partners do they have, and can we go after them to some extent? Because if I'm a true attacker and I'm trying to get to X company, but I know that Y company has a backdoor into them because they're a business partner, and Y company has way less security, I'm going to go after the Y company to get into the X company. I think that's exactly what the supply chain attacks at a very basic level. That's what they are, and I'm not surprised that they're finally coming into their own. But I'm glad all of our friends who have been screaming about it for the last 5 years finally get to go, I told you so.
Right.
Because I don't think anybody was really taking him seriously. Just, what do you think, Justin? I mean,
I think unfortunately, I'm going to stick to my phishing. It's still phishing and BEC, business email compromise. I just don't see it going away. And unfortunately, with more and more remote workers, and having some of the decentralized security, I think we're going to continue to see that, unfortunately. And I think my other one is still the insider threat. With a lot of organizations that had to put so many people on furlough, and I've talked to multiple organizations on trying to get their equipment back, and they're not getting their equipment back timely. They're not necessarily like. Just because the person went on furlough, I've been talking with some different sysadmins, they were not given permission to shut those people off. So these people still had access within the environment. So I would have to say those are my two, from where we're at for the rest of this year.
Okay. Well, we've got exactly 1 minute left. What's the best way for someone to reach out to you for your services?
That would be info@digitalsilence.com. Definitely, it goes to all of us. We don't have a sales team, so you are talking to usually myself, Dan, or Ryan.
Okay, excellent.
We don't have a sales team, so you are talking with people who truly know what your needs could be.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, Ryan and Justin, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I definitely want to do a couple more podcasts. There's so much more to talk about, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Great, man, anytime.
Thank you for your time. Take care.
Yep. All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks, man. Bye, guys.